Hi there, folks. Welcome back to the Fine Wine Confidential podcast. Fred Reno here, your host. I'm excited to share my latest episode, number 27, with you all. It features my interview with Bruce Socklin, one of the world's foremost experts in enology. He joined me in my Charlottesville studio one July morning. Bruce's career started in California, where he was teaching at the Fresno State University in the enology department. He was then recruited in 1985 to head up a new initiative at Virginia Tech University as the head of their enology program. His friends on the West Coast thought he was nuts, as they couldn't fathom any quality wine being produced here in the Old Dominion. Of course, Bruce knew otherwise, and he has made a significant contribution to the quality wine being produced here in Virginia today. He has co-authored books on wine chemistry, written multiple book chapters, research papers, and extension publications. The awards he has earned are too numerous to recite. Let's just jump right into the interview. Bruce, welcome to my podcast. I've been looking forward to having this opportunity, so I want to thank you for giving me your time today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, as I always start, I start at the beginning. What's your story? How did you get into the wine industry, and what drove you into this?
Well, I got into the wine industry with a somewhat circumventive route. As a high school student, wanting to have some beverages for the weekend, I started making some homemade wine, and that was in the era where if someone said to you they were a winemaker, that was analogous to saying I'm a glass blower or something. It was really quite an ethereal, aesthetic kind of endeavor. There were virtually just a tiny handful of winemakers in California at the time that you ever heard anything about. But I started making wine, and then I was a undergraduate at California State University, San Diego, and ended up making some wine as an undergraduate, and went to graduate school. To pay for my graduate school, I worked at a local winery. Still unaware that you could actually make a career out of winemaking. And it just sort of evolved from there.
What winery was that?
It was called Pleasant Products in San Diego. It was owned by a health food company. Again, and this was in the early 70s.
Wow, interesting. Well, then you went on to eventually become a professor at, Fresno State?
Correct. Yes, I actually worked at a couple of other wineries. I worked at a winery in the San Joaquin Valley known as Pirelli Minetti and Sons. And they...
Oh, wow.
They were gracious enough to sponsor my further education. And then from there, I went into academics, always understanding that if I didn't like academics, I would jump back into winemaking. I was not necessarily convinced that an academic career was where I wanted to be, but I always was intrigued and enamored with the science of wine and the science of winemaking. And so I thought that an academic career would be entertaining, and it's been more than entertaining. So I worked in the industry, and in 1985, a position came open at Virginia Tech. My West Coast friends thought it was quite odd that I would entertain the idea of moving to Virginia to work on wine.
How did you learn about the position, if I could ask? Because it's not, 85, that different landscape here, clearly.
I was actually recruited. So I went out for the interview. I had done some consulting in Virginia for Archie Smith's winery. Those that are listening to your podcast that are aware of the early players.
Well, Meredith
Vineyards was a stalwart winery. And so I knew a little bit about Virginia and Virginia wines, although I did realize it was somewhat basic and embryonic. I made the offer that I couldn't refuse, or I didn't refuse, and came to Virginia in I started my job August 17, 1985. I remember the date quite vividly because it was that date I'd gotten a communication from one of my friends in California teasing me that perhaps I'd been in some sort of witness protection program, or maybe I'd been excommunicated from California, because why would anybody voluntarily leave the epicenter, not just of the wine universe, but in their mind, the universe, that epicenter being California?
Right.
Of course, at the time, the wine industry virtually stopped at the California border. And while, yes, there was a little wine made in New York, and of course, that was all sweet, sloppy hybrids, don't you know? And a few little dibs and drabs, even up in Oregon, it hadn't gotten any acclaim at the time, and Washington was not even a bleep on the screen, per se. My friends thought that was really quite tangential, so I had to endure their abstract senses of humor. But to carry this story further, if I may,
please,
I came here right before the harvest of '85, and we had. Let me back up. Virginia Tech, of course, is a research institution. You get invited to stay, that is to say, are given tenure, based primarily on the money that you bring in and the research publications that you create. So therefore, I knew right from the start that I needed to jump in and do some research. I started a project at Prince Michelle Vineyards right before the harvest of '85. And I remember getting a call from the winemaker at the time saying, well, I think you better come up here for those plots of yours are not holding up real well. And by the way, last week we got 13 inches of rain and we're harvesting tomorrow, by the way. So those of you that know the geography of Virginia and know where Virginia Tech is, it's not close to Prince Michelle. So
right.
I got in the car, drove all the way up there. I'd never seen crown gall and bunch rot, and it was the bunch rot that was the real problem at this time, that had been that acute.
Was that Hollerith that was there at the time?
Yes, yes. And so I'm driving back to campus, realizing that this research idea is gotten deep-sixed, and thinking that there's probably people in the local penitentiary that have better career options than I do if I don't get some research going. As almost a function of bad serendipity, I go into the office, my office at the university, and pull out from the mailbox a book that was sent to me by a friend. It was on Wines of America. And imagine my surprise. This was by an author I'll choose not to name, but who's one of those self-proclaimed experts.
Oh, okay.
And I'll define an expert as anyone who guesses correctly more than once. This expert actually had a listing of Virginia in the index. So imagine my surprise at seeing that. I turned to the back of the book to find the almost page and a half on Virginia. And while I can't give you an exact copy or a rendition of exactly what he said, to paraphrase, he said something like this. Yes, they do make wine in Virginia, but one has to wonder why.
I have a copy of that book.
Yeah,
here.
And so my pacemaker practically froze. But, you know, interestingly, it was not simply a commentary on the wine quality, although the wine quality at the time was pretty marginal, because when I came to Virginia, we had 31 wineries making wine, some of which you could even drink. Well, his comment was, it's so much easier to make wine in the arid environs of California. Why would anybody want to do that? Why would anybody want to go through the struggle of trying to grow grapes in the humid, wet, winter problem area of Virginia or the mid-Atlantic in general. But fortunately for us all, this so-called expert did not understand the soon-to-emerge interest in regionalism. Regional cuisine specifically, to which wine fits in very nicely. And it's this interest in regionalism that really helped to kickstart not just the wine industry here, but it throughout the country.
Well, I'm curious about Virginia Tech, because Tony Wolf was recruited or came right after you, I believe, right around the same time.
He came about 6 months later.
Who started that program? Were you part of the beginnings of this program, or was Virginia Tech doing research in enology and viticulture before that?
We have a Department of Food Science and a Department of Horticulture, both of which I'm associated with, that did a little bit of work in both viticulture and enology, but there was no dedicated faculty for that. It was just some people that did a little bit of work. The reason why Virginia Tech got into the grape and wine business in a serious way is the reason why it gets into anything, because of political pressures. There were some influential winemakers, or I should say winery owners, mm-hmm. not winemakers, that had an ear to both state government and the people running the university, and they suggested in their own little not-so-subtle way that they would like some more help, and they got one of the legislators to sponsor a bill to create both a viticulture and enology position at Virginia Tech, including some startup monies. So was that initiative coupled with a very progressive horticulture department chairman, a fellow by the name of Tom Fretz, who really got things off the table and on to action. Tom was the one that actually recruited me. His insight into the potential of the grape and wine industry was really substantive. He realized that the potential was large, and that he wanted his university, and most specifically his Department of Horticulture, to be quite on the forefront of that. So both Tony and myself were hired into the Department of Horticulture, even though enology, the science of winemaking, is not traditionally a horticultural aspect. Tom was astute enough to realize that those sort of lines of distinction are irrelevant anyway. And he understood that this relationship, the synergism between agriculture, production, marketing, tourism, and tax revenues were added new meaning to that term, value added, and was very instrumental in getting the rest of the university on board with this. You don't just start programs. You got to convince every other person whose last name begins with a capital letter who's an administrator right. that this is a good idea. And Tom was not only a good department chairman, he was a good salesman and a good navigator, and he did a lot of the spade work. It really allows the industry to be where it is today.
So from your perspective then, building on that, you come in here in 85 and it was very embryonic. I mean, Barboursville was just probably beginning to get known and things of that nature. Yeah, we're having a glass of white Burgundy here, by the way, folks, just by full disclosure, and it's quite good. The question being very simple, what was the turning point from your experience and your standpoint that all of a sudden Virginia, as an industry, started to really make some incredible wine, multiple producers, as opposed to this guy over here or this guy's actually making something you can drink?
Well, for the most part,
if you could point to it.
Yes, for the most part, it's a sort of epicycle kind of advancement, but there were a few hallmarks. Early on, we did very well with the whites, particularly Chardonnay. Chardonnay is a very elastic grape, so it's very forgiving. That's why it's planted so ubiquitously. But if I had to pick a turning point, I guess it would be the vintage of 03, which was, by anybody's definition, terrible. Lots of rain, no sun, all of the worst conditions possible. However, despite the fact that environmentally could not have been much worse, there were a surprising number of vintners that crafted some very credible wines, and particularly credible given what they had to work with. And for me, that was a point where I realized, wow, maybe we are finally getting it together. When I say credible wines, particularly red wines, and we had put in the early 90s a lot of emphasis on trying to make our wines, red wines, much more supple. We were trying to go into that sort of French mantra of making wines for keeping and wines for drinking. And prior to that, we did not have the best of either world because the wines would fade pretty quickly in the bottle, and frequently they were very angular and tight, tannic, acidic red wines are not popular by any
right.
by any measure. So I'd say 03 was a demarcation point. But I think what's happened here is that we have worked collectively as an industry. We established these winemaker roundtables that I'd mentioned to you that were gatherings of regional winemakers who would come in, sit down, they bring wines from the cellar, unbottled. I would always make sure that these were unfinished wines, because when they're in the bottle, they're in the bottle. It is what it is after that. Train's left the station. And we would critique these blindly, and I would lead the discussion, and we began a sort of a systematic exchange of ideas and of thoughts, so as to allow me, instead of going to a whole host of winemakers and saying the same thing, I would, in a group, make some suggestions, and the winemakers, no doubt, learned as much, if not more, from fellow winemakers than they learned from me. And it was this sort of sense of community that I think is a huge reason why the Virginia wine industry has propelled to the high echelon that it has held now.
Well, I have seen this collegiality since I moved here in 2019, and it's refreshing to see that it's growing on itself. There's still a lot of information sharing. There's still a lot of cooperation. There's still a lot of people working together. It clearly reminds me of the late 70s and early 80s in California and up in Oregon. Of course, that's all changed. It's become very corporate, but...
Well, it used to be it's the us against everybody else idea. Now it's, I think there's some significant friendships made. It's more the pleasure of the cooperative interaction than it is any kind of us against them, because they've already, I mean, we're still competing with everybody else.
Right.
I mean, the wine industry adds new meaning to the term global marketplace.
That's for sure. There's no question about that. So tell me about, jumping around here a little bit, this organization that you're the coordinator of, I believe. It's called the Applied Research Cooperative Federation of Wineries for California, Oregon, and Washington. Is that just a West Coast collective?
It was established by a French products company called Lafort. And it's analogous to our Virginia Winemakers Research Exchange. And it is designed to do just what I've been talking about, sharing ideas. In this case, the idea was that there's all of this information coming from the land-grant universities such as mine, such as Virginia Tech. And it's like that old saying, there's so much to learn and so little of it worth learning. Winemakers very seldom read the Journal of American Society of Enology and Viticulture because to them, a lot of that is way too esoteric. It's not practically oriented and it doesn't relate to them. And some of that criticism is justified, maybe not all of it. But the point is that the Wine Research Exchange and ARC, Lafort program, were established to have winemakers conduct in-house projects under the supervision of researchers who would aid in the establishment and the layout of research projects, but that the projects would be implemented by the winemakers and be done to satisfy limiting conditions that the winemakers would be facing. And those conditions are really boil down to two issues. I mean, is it going to increase wine quality? Is it going to lower cost of production, or both? And if it doesn't follow within one or two of those, then it's not usually performed. And so it's simple things like we're doing with the winemakers exchange, different yeast, different barrel treatments, rack and return versus not, that sort of practical stuff, that practical decisions that winemakers have to make to in order to be able to dial in their own stylistic goals.
Got it. Now I understand. So I believe I understand the difference clearly, but if you were going to say, what's the number one thing that's different about growing grapes in California versus growing grapes in Virginia? If there's one thing that's like, that's the difference.
The major differences that we're working on are water management. We've done a lot of work in understanding the relationship between water management and terroir. In fact, if we were to break terroir down to its core element, the core element, it would be hydrology and water uptake, water use. So what's occurring now is a great deal of effort in trying to understand water management issues on the West Coast. And by that, I mean to say when we should require the plant to have some moisture stress and when we shouldn't. Moisture stress in the plant at the right time can increase the production of secondary metabolites. Secondary metabolites are essentially aroma, flavor, and phenolic compounds. And they are the things that make great wines, and therefore, because we're in a competitive market, a lot of people are looking to see how they can maximize those in their grapes. And the easiest way to maximize them with our current understanding is to be able to control plant moisture. Now, in Virginia, we can't control plant moisture. It's much more European in style. Of course, as you well know, most European vineyards, it's not even, certainly most French vineyards, it's not legal to irrigate.
Right.
But that is a primary difference. Now, back to your question, there are, of course, plenty of other differences. We used to say in Virginia, after we got through a devastating winter that would wipe out the crop, or we got spring frost, or we got a tidal wave of sour rot, that we used to think that we had all of the problems and none of the benefits. But I have to say, I'm working on the West Coast, and particularly being involved in looking at the impacts of smoke taint, our problems are still our problems, and although not unique to Virginia, but it's certainly not safe to say that it's altogether that much easier out in California.
Well,
not these days.
I'm starting to believe that the West Coast of the United States is not the future of wine growing.
It's interesting that you mention that, because there are a few winemakers that are beginning to think, West Coast winemakers that are beginning to think that too. It's kind of abstractly amusing. I did mention the reaction I got from my academic and industry colleagues about when I first got out here to Virginia. But over the years, the number of inquiries that I have received about requesting information about positions out here, either in the industry or academics, has definitely gone up, and it's gone up geometrically over the years.
Well, and from what I see, and I want to touch on this, because you wrote an extensive piece, which I read the other day, about climate change that was quite, well, brilliant, I must say. I mean, it really laid it out in full detail about what you see and what is happening here. I saw this in my career before I left California. It was getting more and more difficult to get what I call physiological ripeness of the grape at 24 degrees sugar brick. And so everybody was letting it go 25, 25 and a half, 26, 27, trying to get that physiological ripeness. Then they would make the wine, de-alk it, sometimes water back, but generally de-alk it, and that just stripped the soul out of the wine. And so all of a sudden you can line up a dozen Russian River Pinot Noirs, and they all taste the same. There's no soul in the wine, and that's what attracted me to Virginia. Was all of a sudden I'm trying these Virginian wines, and there was soul in these wines still. There was some, it was talking to you.
Yes, this concept of minimalistic winemaking kind of gets bandied about in undefined terms, but it is safe to say that relative to manipulation, we're making wines in a lot simpler fashion here. We don't have, with the exception of, say, 2010, a situation where we have excessive alcohols that make these wines kind of clumsy. Usually our wines are much better food complements than you would see in many California regions. We don't have a requirement to put on this extended hang time, which allows for a greater concentration of alcohol to get a commensurate amount of aroma, flavor, and phenolics.
So the biggest change, you would say, about climate change, what have you seen here in Virginia, if you've seen climate change here?
Well, the biggest problem with climate change is the increased variability, the unpredictability of the climate. As I mentioned, I think in that article that you're referring to, the harvest dates in several regions in France have been moved up by about 3 weeks over the last 20 years, and that's a big issue. You've got the unpredictable weather, which means that you're going to have droughts and you're going to have floods, and that's a problem. The other problem that's not discussed much but will continue to be a factor is the increased level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, plants, of course, use carbon dioxide, but a higher level of carbon dioxide causes a physiological change in a plant. And you mentioned the bricks, the soluble solids or sugar content of the grape and its relationship to aroma, flavor, and phenolic compounds is very important. In California, that relationship, that divide between the sugar level at harvest, at a normal harvest, say 20 bricks, 22 bricks, we'll say, and aroma and flavor is not very good, and that's why you have to have the fruit hang longer. The Brix goes up primarily as a function of dehydration, so you get enough aroma and flavor. So there's a spread between the Brix and the aroma and flavor and phenolic compounds. The more CO2 in the atmosphere, the wider that spread is going to become because of what's known as phloem loading.
Well, that's
for a function of the plant physiology.
That's really interesting. And for you listeners out here, I would encourage you to go online. This article is in Wines and Vines, from the February 2018 magazine issued by Bruce Socklin. It's worth a read. Check it out. It's very good. I was like, okay, now I get that part of it. It's really nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you told me who started the Virginia Technology Program. What is the state? I mean, you're retired. I assume you're still active with them. Do they still have a really robust, ongoing department with enology classes, viticultural classes? What's happening there at Virginia Tech?
Yes, I'm still involved. I still have an office on campus. When I hired, they replaced my position with two people. One, I had a dual appointment, teaching, research, and extension.
Right.
They hired a separate extension enologist, Beth Chang. Excellent enologist, and a fermentation researcher, Amanda Stewart.
Oh, I see. Okay, so they broke it into two. Yeah, for the listeners who don't understand, extension is applying the science, and correct me if I'm wrong here, at the winery level, and the research, of course, is doing the research.
Right. Yeah, we had a very active extension program trying to provide, well, you know, there's this saying that the faster we develop the science, the greater is the likelihood between what we know and what we actually do. So the idea with extension is, of course, to minimize that difference so that what we know can be applied, assuming that it's applicable, again, under the two primary headers lowering the cost of production or increasing quality. So our extension program is definitely oriented around those two features. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. You know, so if a vintner asks a question about what time is it, we don't want to tell them how watches are made. We want to get right to the point. And that's what they're interested in. That's part of being a practitioner. You want to know what the practices are, not the theory.
Well, one of my things that I'm really interested in your opinion on, having been here as long as you have been, is the future of hybrids in Virginia and vinifera. Admittedly, I really didn't know much about hybrids because I spent well over most of my career on the West Coast. But when I came here, I started tasting them, and I've become a big fan of well-made Chambersin. I've become a fan of Sauvignon Blanc, personally well-made. I know why hybrids have somewhat of a stigma, but where is this going to go in the future, given climate change, farming practices, everything else involved with hybrids versus vinifera? What do you think?
Well, I think we are evolving. The problem with hybrids is one of perception and legacy. Early on, the East Coast and Midwest producers in this country were presumed to be making nothing but poorly made hybrid wines. And so some of that criticism was perhaps justified, but not in all cases, of course. There was, and still is to a certain degree, a certain amount of what I would loosely term viticultural racism. And that is to say, if you put a hybrid name on a bottle of wine and try and sell it to a retailer or a wholesale house, they'd look the other way, if not run the other way. However, if you take that same bottle, put a proprietary label on it, and have them taste it, then that's a different story. I think, as you mentioned, with climate change and with the market change. So we have climate, we have environmental climate, we also have market climate. I think both of those are changing to allow more hybrid wine, hybrid wines in the marketplace. The young people that I talk to and I interact with, particularly on the West Coast, are not at all hung up with a wine being from Napa or a Pinot Noir being from Burgundy. They don't give a you-know-what. Mm-hmm. What they want is a decent value. That's the only thing. And so they're not so hung up on the perceived esteem that hangs some of us up with. And so I think they're going to be quite receptive to all kinds of new products. They already are. You can see that in the marketplace, right, with the proliferation of everything out there now. And that wouldn't happen if the young people weren't buying them. So I think the future is bright if, as long as the wines are made well. No problem with that. In fact, I had a former student of mine who was a master's student, went up to the University of Minnesota solely to work with a fellow who was a breeder. Peter Hempstead was his name, who was breeding hybrid varieties, and she was in charge of making wines for those to evaluate for commercial sales. And some of those, Marquette and others, are really quite popularized now.
Well, that's interesting. In fact, I remember Ben Jordan, when I interviewed him, said, well, I thought I had to make vinifera because when I moved back to Virginia, that was what everybody had. He said, now I learned if you just make the wine that the hybrid, the grape itself, will give you, as opposed to trying to make it something it's not, you really can make some compelling, interesting wines.
Yeah, I think that's the whole point. We were very Virginia-centric. Our many people were attempting to make Virginia vinifera-centric in the early days because it was this sort of sense of insecurity. Being in a new embryonic wine region, you have to stroke harder to get any kind of attention. And there was this perception that no matter how hard you stroked, if you weren't making vinifera wine, nobody was going to write anything about it. We've gotten over that a little bit. We're still vinifera-oriented, but I think a lot of the focus on vinifera and away from the hybrids was in part because that's what they presumed the wine writers and the other gatekeepers insisted on. Now the things are liberalized a little bit, and as you say, Ben and other people have the right idea that you go with the flow. Exercise the features of the particular grape at your particular site. I think things are changing.
Okay, a personal question. My favorite question to ask everybody sitting in that chair. What was the one wine you had in your lifetime that you went, wow, that's it. That's the sort of the epiphany wine that said, man, wine can be this good, this interesting. What's that one wine at some point in your life, your career you had?
I'm not sure that I could say one wine. Unfortunately, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of traveling, taste a lot of wines.
Well, that's okay.
I had, in my younger year, early academic years, I had an opportunity to taste an 82 Latour, which instilled to me why it had first growth status.
Gotcha.
I got it then. You know, it didn't seem academic after that.
Okay, I'm going with that. I mean, that's really good. I could see how that would be. Boom.
Yeah.
So it says you've also been involved a lot and do a lot of planning in winery design. How'd you get involved in that piece of the business itself?
By knowing the people that know something about that. I gave and organized programs on winery planning and design initially in Virginia, because we'd have these people inherit a barn or something and want to put in the middle of nowhere or at the edge of the earth and you turn right and they want to put a winery in. And I would send them a business plan and say, well, you ought to think about this, that, and the other. And for the business plan, they'd write back and say, well, we want to make, and I'd always ask them, which wines would you like to emulate? Or which, I ask them a kind of this reciprocal of the question that you just asked me. What wines are your favorites, or what wines really got you into this, or what would you like to emulate? And I remember this one gal wrote me back. She said she wanted to make Howl Mountain Cabernet. Well, that's intriguing. So you have a winery or a vineyard in Howl Mountain? No. And it's like that the old story about you can't get there from here. But anyway, so those sort of inputs suggested to me that maybe we should start some programs. And so we began a couple, and then they became regional, and then they became national. And now I have a book. It's called Winery Planning and Design. And I'm the editor, and it has presentations from people who actually know what they're doing, from engineers, from architects, to people that specialize in sustainability. About a third of it is on sustainable features, from building materials to solar designs to a green roost, you name it.
What do you think the biggest challenge for Virginia as a wine industry as a whole right now, looking forward over the next decade or two decades, what's the biggest challenge that they're going to have to meet and deal with?
Climate change.
So that's what everybody's going to be dealing with, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow. Okay, so what's the second?
What's the second thing they'll have to deal with?
Yeah, the biggest challenge, putting climate change aside.
Oh, I guess there's still a perception on the part of some people that it's a regional industry, how good can the wines be? But that, through your efforts and efforts of others, that problem is being addressed.
Boy, I sure hope so. If I can make a difference, that's what I'm trying to do. I can tell you folks, buy a bottle of Virginia wine. There's a lot of damn good wine out there. There's no question about that, you know.
We still have the concerns of, it's climate change. I mean, it's winter hardiness. That's always a feature. But fortunately, with the work of our viticulturists, people are planting grapes in much more suitable spots. And we're slowly, if not rapidly, getting it together, to use the common vernacular.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Well, Bruce, I can't say thank you enough. This has been interesting and very enlightening. Very enlightening. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, folks, as you can see from that interview, Bruce has contributed to the Virginia winemaking community in a significant way. Hats off to Virginia Tech for recruiting him. And although he's retired from his position, it was clear to me he is nowhere near retirement, as he keeps consulting and providing insights to a wide range of publications and wine associations. Lucky for them. In my upcoming episode, which was guided by a suggestion from several vintners, that I interview some of the upcoming younger folks here in Virginia who will be the future. Specifically, I was encouraged to interview two young ladies, Corey Craighill from Septenary Winery and Ashley White from Glen Manor Vineyards. I was told they were good friends and it would be lively and fun discussion. And then the night before, I decided to add a twist to the interview, and I brought a bottle of white Burgundy to share with them during the taping. It's a wonderful episode, nice dynamics, you don't want to miss it. As always, thanks for being a listener. Hit that subscribe button and send any comments or inquiries to me at fred@finewineconfidential.com. See you on the other side. Music at Fine Wine Confidential podcast by Jason Shaw at audionautics.com from his copyrighted song Acoustic Shuffle under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License. I hope you enjoyed the show.